Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You have my sword.
And you have my bow.
And my trowel.
Hello, you're listening to episode 17 of And My Trowel, where we look at the fantastic side of archaeology and the archaeological side of fantasy. My name's Tilly.
And I'm Ash.
And today, we're delving into the creatures of the night, those that feast on the blood of the living.
Oh my god, vampires!
Yes, Ash, vampires.
Hell yes!
So yes, we're looking at the bloodsuckers of legends, immortal beings who stalk the nights in search of prey, because, well, so Ash, we've been given a bit of a problem to fix. One of the latest excavations by Helsing Holmes has hit a bit of a snag. And of course, as you're aware, Ash, they're one of the biggest sustainable housing companies this side of the fictional world. They provide homes for most of the mythical creatures on this land. It's a bit of a reparative measure, since the Helsings often hunted their ancestors during the Dark Ages. Less said about that, the better. Mm. But now, Helsing's recent development to house the rapidly growing werewolf population since the big bite of 2019 has hit a massive snag, because they found burials.
Oh no, that's... I mean, that's not really a problem. I mean, we can get a team together,
Unfortunately, that's not all. They found human burials with vampire teeth buried with them.
Oh, okay. No, hang on. Are we talking about dentures, grave goods here? What are we talking?
Grave goods, indeed. So there was a bag placed behind the head during the burial, and they're in a number of different burials, by the way. So along with swords, silver bullets, and also a few organic finds that have a remarkable appearance of stakes.
Ah, so we're talking hunter burials. Mm-hmm. Maybe even Van Helsing associated burials. Okay, well, that's a bit of a sticky situation. But can I ask, how do we know they're vampire teeth?
They've been identified by the living vampire who happens to be missing their fangs.
Ah, this is a pickle.
Exactly. But luckily, I happen to have a specialist on call right now. Ash, I'd like you to meet Jessica Van Dom, who just so happens to be a forensic anthropologist and osteoarchaeologist, and she knows quite a bit about teeth. Welcome, Jess.
Hi.
Oh my god, hi. Lovely to meet you. Thanks so much for joining us. Tell us a little bit about yourself, Jess.
Well, first, thanks for having me.
Well, I must say, I said teeth. Is that your specialism?
Is that your specialism?
It was. I've gathered a few degrees over the years. So at the moment, I'm actually an art conservator.
Oh. Also useful. We'll keep that in mind.
Yes.
Yeah,
it's very useful. Yeah.
But my archaeology degree, the research focused on aging or estimating age at death in archaeological contexts using teeth.
Very cool.
Oh, you're going to be very handy.
And in terms of, so you're a forensic anthropologist and an osteoarchaeologist. How did that come about? How did you get into that?
Well, forensic anthropology, I don't know if you remember the show Bones that was
oh my
on.
God, I love Bones.
Yeah. Pretty good. That came out right before I was supposed to go to uni. And I was like, oh, that's a job. I should get that job. So I'll go study that.
Imagine if you'd be watching a different show. Like, your life would have been so different.
Yeah, like Cash Converters or like Ones Under the Hammer.
Ghost Adventures.
Yeah, Ghost Adventures. Oh my God.
Well, what's funny is that around the same time I was watching Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which seemed less marketable somehow.
Well, it's useful today.
It would be hard to get work, I think, but you never know.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like it's a sort of underpaid profession, vampire hunting.
A lot of freelance
dangerous.
Work.
Yeah. Very dangerous, yeah.
We'll have to ask the Helsings, but...
Yeah.
Paid under the table. Yeah. But okay. And then I'm not sure if this is a question that we'll be dealing with later on, but in terms of forensic anthropology and osteoarchaeology, is there a difference?
Sort of yes and sort of no. So forensic anthropology really focuses on more recent deaths that could be related to a criminal case. So like the word forensics means that it's somehow related to law in some way or other. And so if there's a suspicious death in the woods, like a skeleton is found in the woods and they're like, oh, this could be 200 years old or it could be 100 or it could be 5 or a month. That can all sort of fall under the forensics category. And then osteoarchaeology is like more distinctly old burials or archaeologically found human remains.
Right. Okay.
Right. Okay. That makes sense. Yeah. That makes sense. And so you're not in the kind of field at the moment, but is there anything that you're working on right now that's related or has been related or in your art conservatoire?
So... 2 summers ago, I worked on a ancient Egyptian mummy for a small university in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, what's he doing in Pennsylvania?
You know, there are mummies all over the states, and they are in the strangest places, honestly. This one they kept in a library.
Oh.
Yeah, from like I think they got it in like the 1880s. And so there was a lot of like stories about like student pranks and like bringing it into dorms. And so what was very interesting specifically was that this mummy is so heavy. There is no way they carried it into anybody's dorm room. Maybe the skull because it was unwrapped, like just the head was unwrapped, but the rest wasn't.
Wow.
So that was fun to both work on it in a art conservation context, but also in a osteological context because her skull was visible.
That's so interesting. That's mad. And there was anything like, I just like, I can't picture it. I mean, I know the Victorians are obviously took a lot of stuff and they used to eat mummies. Did you know that? I found that out recently. It was a delicacy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, who hasn't, you know, nibbled on a little wrapped ancient carcass? I mean,
I was like, tell you, we're very different people because I haven't.
or turn it into paint pigment, you know?
That's
mummy brown.
Mummy brown, yeah.
Mummy brown.
No, it's actually called that.
I know, but it just sounds so horrible.
There was a painter that exclusively used mummy brown, and he did, I don't know who it is, but I saw it online, and he didn't know what it was, and then he found out, and he cried. He kept crying and tried to destroy all of his work because it was human remains. He was really upset about it. Yeah.
I feel better for him now. I was thinking, oh my gosh, what a horrible person using crushed up mummies for that painting. And then, okay, he didn't realize. Oh.
He had no clue. And it was of the time, like he was Victorian. I just can't remember his name now. I'll try and find it.
We'll randomly slip it in somewhere in the rest of the episode. There you go. There's your teaser, everyone listening in. Listen in to the rest of this episode to hear which painter used mummy brown. And so... So obviously you have moved on to something different now. You've gone in a slightly different direction. But if we go back to kind of forensic anthropology, osteoarchaeology, teeth, what sort of did you find kind of enjoyable about that topic? I mean, you did it for so long. You did a couple of degrees, as you said, in that topic. So what was for you the most kind of exciting thing about that topic?
What I found really interesting is that you can figure out when a skeleton was damaged. So like skeletal trauma is different depending on if you're alive or if you're dead or if you're very, very dead. So in an archaeological context, that's interesting because you could say, oh, is this a trowel that broke this rib? Or was this rib already broken? You know, like those kind of timeline context clues can be visible. And so that's really interesting to me. Yeah. I don't know how I ended up with teeth, in all honesty, but somehow I did.
Someone's got to take the teeth.
Yeah.
I just like your definition of very, very dead. It's like, you know, that skit of if you go out or if you're going out.
Exactly. If you're pregnant or you're very pregnant. Yeah.
There are different stages of dead. Did you not know this?
I mean, that's what we're going to find out today, I guess.
Yeah, what is vampire characterized as?
Dead and there's undead, yeah.
So if that's the most interesting bit, what's the most frustrating that you've had in your specialism? Frustrating thing?
I think it's a very repetitive field, especially osteoarchaeology, because if you're excavating it like an entire cemetery and you have, say, 100 skeletons, you're running a lot of the same tests. So you're taking the same measurements and you're, you know, looking at different like data points. And so you're just collecting data about these skeletons. And so the skeletal trauma and the paleopathology, so like any sort of illness that could affect bones, is not necessarily studied immediately. And so it's like, it's just a lot of data collection, which I find rather boring. I like the more like, oh, look at this oddity and what can I find out about this oddity? But the other problem is that, going back to paleopathology, is that a lot of illnesses can present similarly. So like, you know, like if you have lesions on the rib, so like there's some sort of like weirdly molded bone on the inside of the ribs, that could be a sign of like tuberculosis if they had it long enough. But it could also be a sign of some sort of cancer. It could be a sign of some other respiratory disease. It could be, I don't know, a cyst. It could be, there's so many things that these things can be. And so like you can say, oh, they likely had these things, or they may have had this problem, or they could have died from this, but there's no real certainty. And so that's a little frustrating.
I feel like that's the main thing with archaeology in general. Like everything you say is like, but this is just purely based on my own interpretation of this particular sign. And
it's certainly ritualistic.
Hey! We need a ritual button. We keep saying this.
I know. I'm going to make a little audio going ritual with like echoing, and Rachel can just add it in whenever we say ritual.
It makes me think of the Claxton on QI.
QI,
yes. Oh my gosh, you should definitely do that. That'd be good, yeah. Fantastic, brilliant. So since we're in a fantasy world and a fantasy context, the next question we have for you is, do you actually enjoy reading fantasy?
I love fantasy. One of my top genres.
Oh my goodness, that would be terrible otherwise.
No, I hate fantasy.
I don't think I would have been on this podcast if that had been a no answer, but...
Oh yeah, that's fair. So what's your favorite fantasy book or even series?
Oh, that is a really challenging question. One that I read recently, because you probably have this problem where, you know, you read a ton of books, but some of them don't grab your attention as much. But this one I could not put down. So like read it in one sitting. It was Girl Who Fell Beneath the Sea by Axie Oh. So it's a Korean mythology retelling of the sea god's bride. So it's just, it's really well written, lovely, like the images that you conjure up in your mind while you're reading it. Oh, it's so good.
That's sitting on my shelf next to my bed, coming closer and closer to the top of the To Be Read pile. I feel like a certain American I know gave that to me.
Weird coincidence, right?
I'm afraid strange. I haven't read it yet, but it is on my pile and I'm working my way through it gradually.
That's is totally it
underneath
fine.
All the Terry Pratchett's?
The Terry Pratchett's have been read. They're fine. Ah. They're all good.
Oh, I did finally read the Terry Pratchett's, Matilda.
Another one bites the dust. I've also sent ones to Ash to try.
Yes. Weird sisters.
Oh, see, I started with the audiobooks and I did Going Postal first. So I know it's out of order.
I did,
but because it's
well.
Later, you get like a better, I don't know.
It's a better overview. This is the problem with those ones. But that's like actually Rachel, our lovely editor, who's currently probably listening to this right now, going, oh, for God's sake, Matilda, stop talking about Harry Potter.
Stay on topic.
During our meeting the other day, she said, Matilda, I downloaded Colour of Magic. Which is good. But at the same time, I did tell her, oh, you might be disappointed if you start with that one because it's not the best. But anyway, sorry. I apologize, Ash. I'm really sorry. I genuinely did not mean it. You brought it up this time.
I know I did. I did. I thought you needed it.
Oh, don't worry. There are plenty of vampires in Harry Potter. We're going to get fine. They're going to be vampires. So.
Oh, but for a vampire series, I highly recommend Strange Practice by Vivian Shaw.
Ooh.
It's about Greta Van Helsing, and she's a doctor for monsters.
I've read that one.
It's so cute. Yeah. And there's mummies in it and trolls and very fun. So highly recommend that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That was a good one. I'm going to get it.
So, Jess, do you think that you will be able to help us with our problem that we're having here?
I do hope so.
Good. Oh, wait, hang on a sec. Sorry, my books are starting to fly around the room again. Hang on, they must need to tell me something. Let me just quickly talk to them and we will be right back.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome back. Okay, so it turns out the books did actually want to tell us a few things specifically about vampires.
They were incredibly informative. Mm-hmm. But books aside, I want to know first and foremost, Tilly, Jess, what do you guys know about vampires?
Well, I know about vampires from what I've read in a series, which I don't know if I've told you guys about this series of books that I've read. And I mean,
Twilight, I knew it.
Twihard, it had to be.
Has to be. Tilly's favourite book series.
They sparkle, right?
Yeah, they sparkle.
So, weirdly enough, there are vampires in Discworld. but unfortunately, I mean, I knew about vampires before from various things in terms of the good old, you know, they drink blood, they've got pointy teeth, and but then the problem is now I think I've read the Discworld book so many times that that's kind of ingrained on my mind now, the physical vampires from there, which they basically play into the stereotype. So they always dress in evening wear and they always have like slicked hair and all this kind of stuff,
and the awkward cape.
Yeah, right.
Oh my God, okay. Yeah.
Exactly. There's even one of my favorite characters is called Otto Schrink, who's a vampire, and he's a photographer, but he has like a photographer's vest, but it has tails and a bow tie as well. Like it's so yeah. But so I don't know, like I feel like that's sort of a nighttime, they can't go out in the sun. But that's sort of as much as I know, but I feel like Jess is probably a little more aware vampire kind of in popular fiction and in mythology and things, because she's the one that introduced me to quite a lot of vampire related fiction.
I mean, there is a lot, and I like what's interesting is that the like vampire myth has evolved so drastically. I feel like especially like in recent media there's like different like lore about them. Like, you know, in the Buffy universe, there's they like, you know, if you stake them, they poof, turn into dust. And if you and oh, in Discworld, you know, his photographer's flashbulb turns him into dust.
True. And he has and to then have a little vial of blood around his neck so that it splashes on it and it blossoms him up again, because otherwise people keep having to find blood everywhere to get him back to life.
What a profession to choose.
Right? That's what they keep saying to him, and he's like, but light is my passion.
Well, and then there's like, there's the Vampire Diaries where they like hire a witch so that they can go out in the sunlight, but then they like sort of like if they're staked, they desiccate.
Oh,
and so they like, they have the like rings, mummify.
Don't they?
Yeah,
like a ring.
Ooh.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's a good segue, because we've talked about like popular fiction, but the kind of traditional definition of a vampire, I'll tell you what it is, right?
Thanks, okay,
please do.
Yeah. So a vampire is a mythical creature that survives by feeding on the essence of the living. This is often framed as blood, but it can be more ephemeral, like a life essence, or even emotions. So you could, like, if you've ever seen What We Do in the Shadows, there's the kind of vampiric kind of guy who's in the office, and he's an energy vampire. It's like that. And then in European folklore, vampires are undead creatures that often visit loved ones from beyond the grave and cause mischief or death in areas they've inhabited when they were alive.
Which I guess makes sense, that idea of it being like, it's not always blood. Because if you say like, oh, they're a bit of a vampire, then it's like, isn't that a saying? Like, oh, they're a bit of a vampire. They kind of suck the life out of you. Like they sort of, take drain your energy.
I think the term energy vampire is still used as like to refer to like really extroverted people who like always claim the spotlight, but you feel exhausted being around them.
Yeah, they just like somehow suck your energy out of you. You're like, how are you so energetic? Yeah. Like, stop. Completely. Or like, you haven't had your coffee in the morning and you're like, please stop singing.
I think I live with two little vampires right now.
Yeah, I was going to say, children, I think children are a little energy vampires.
How do you still have so much energy?
And I think where the kind of blood comes into it is it becomes, especially when, you know, Bram Stoker, he writes Dracula, it becomes a idea of sex. So the fangs and penetration and then blood is, all that sort of stuff. But there's actually the notion of vampirism has existed in many forms and for many different cultures for centuries, even millennia. So there's some cool archaeological and mythological vampire examples you can talk about. So I don't know if you've heard of the Mesopotamian blood-drinking demon Lamashu.
I mean, that sounds, pretty blood-drinking.
It sounds cool.
Pretty vampiristic to me.
It does, doesn't it? So they all kind of interconnect, all these kind of mythological features and creatures and things. But so there's Lamashu, she's the daughter of the sky god Anu. There's depictions of pottery, like actual pieces of pottery, of blood-drinking demons that relate to her and her children. So this then interconnects with the kind of Jewish mythological figure of Lilith, who in the early medieval period becomes known as the first wife of Adam, who doesn't want to marry Adam, which is fair. I mean, who would? And then decides that she's going to actually become the mother of demons.
That sounds like much more fun,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, either marry boring old Adam and become part of his rib or something, and then, become the queen of demons? Like, sounds better.
I like the power concept there. That just sounds nice.
Yeah, right?
Like, I feel like in Greek mythology there was something vampiristic that I had seen somewhere. Because I remember being surprised when I saw it and I was like, hey, like, really? They had vampires in ancient Greece? Because that just seems so out of place for me.
Yeah, there's Lamia.
Oh, Lamia.
Who is like a snake. Well, she's a woman whose children are killed, because they are Zeus's children, by Hera, because she loves doing that.
I mean, she loves a jealous rage. Put up with, to be fair.
You might have also heard of the poem Lamia as well, and it's kind of like she's like a snake entity, and then she swears vengeance and basically preys on the blood of mothers and babies, which is somewhat counterintuitive, actually, if you think about it, because her children were slaughtered. But most of these early vampiric figures are women who target other mothers and babies.
I mean, we've spoken before in this podcast how, like, people who did mythology in the early days of folklore just didn't seem to like women for some reason.
What? That's crazy.
That's so weird. It's like we live in a patriarchal society.
Yeah, well, right. So bizarre.
Women maligned? Never.
We have the title of our podcast.
Yes. Women maligned.
Women maligned. A podcast.
Don't be ridiculous. But are these like when it's, because it's just such a visual, I mean, is that visual of the kind of, because all of these mythologies and all of these folklores are definitely a lot more removed, I suppose, visually from what we would think of when we depict a vampire. I mean, I guess when you depict a vampire, you'd think of someone more kind of European, I guess, or like more, you know, it's like the pale skin and the dark hair and the evening dress and, you know, all of that kind of thing. So did that also start early on, or is that something that's just happened because of Bram Stoker's novel?
Well, weirdly enough, actually, vampires were a major source of anxiety in medieval and early modern Europe.
Oh, okay. So,
like, actually documented that people were worried about vampires at the time. So you have chroniclers like the 12th century chronicler William of Nuremberg, who basically records these rise in vampire like sightings called revenants, which are different. So they arise from the grave and do the same thing, kind of thing. They go about their day, or they'll go and terrorize their loved ones. So they'll like knock on the door and they'll come in and they won't know. They'll be like, oh my God, wow, you're alive. Oh, amazing. And then they'll go, oh, but they're dripping blood from their mouth and their hair's grown longer and their nails are really long.
Classic Bob, really.
I know.
Always like to play those games.
Really let himself go.
Yeah, he really did. Like, what's with the rotting flesh, Bob? But you also have, even into the 17th century as well, you've got a monk called Antonin Augustin Chalmé, who records reports of literally interred dead noisily feeding on their own flesh within their graves.
Ooh.
Oh, man.
So they were just so hungry and needing blood that they would just gnaw on themselves, essentially.
Oh, okay. Ooh.
And then you get, even in the 18th century, you get vampire attacks happening as well. So they become extremely frequent in East Prussia and the Habsburg. There's two major incidents from the 1720s to the 1730s where literally they are seeing the walking dead come along and consuming the blood of the living.
Oh, gosh.
Is it blood?
Is it blood?
Which, I mean, I guess that's sort of still quite Europe-based. I mean, Jess, you're based across the pond, as we say.
Yes. Under the colonists.
But we've already spoken about surprising amount of mummies being in the US, but what about vampires? Was that also a thing in the US?
It was. So in New England specifically, which is where I'm from, there was a vampire panic, quote unquote, in the 18th and early 19th centuries. And so it really stemmed from tuberculosis, which was rampant at the time. And so the first member of the family to die, they would have no connection between their death and then the future deaths of family members. Because of course, you know, the person with tuberculosis is like sick in bed and everybody's crowded around and like breathing in the same air, delightful. And they're like, oh no, they've died. And it's not that we've been past this disease or this bacterium. It's that they are coming back from the grave and sucking the life out of us, because the typical signs of consumption are being super pale and, you know, you're wasting away. And so it's consuming you from the inside, which is why they call it consumption. And so there's like specific records in Rhode Island, I think, where people would dig up the first family member to die and check if there's fresh blood in their body. And if they were, they would burn the heart and then give the ashes of the burned heart to the dying family members as
great,
lovely sounding cure, which obviously did nothing.
So that really helped with the infection.
Yeah, no, I don't think charred heart is really going to be the thing, but That was their theory. There's also archaeological record from New England where people would be buried inverted, or if they were already skeletonized by the time they figured out who the first person who died was, they would rearrange the skeleton. So like the leg bone, like the femurs would be crossed on the chest with a skull on top, like a skull and crossbones. Oh. Or the skull would be placed in between the feet. Basically anything that would keep them from coming back from the grave.
Do you know, it just makes me wonder, like, how did they know what the vampire looked like? So would it be because of the pale skin and the consumption looking esqueness? How would they figure that out?
I mean, other than, I have no idea, because there's no records of like them seeing the previously deceased person. So they're just like, oh, they must be coming back from the grave and sucking the life force out of these people. And so like there's rumor that Bram Stoker got some of his inspiration from the New England Vampire Panic, because he was on tour with some theater company at the time. Mm-hmm. Other people think the timelines don't quite line up because he wrote it for 7 years. But I think it's Mina Harker, right, who starts like wasting away when Dracula comes and visits her. And so it's like a similar concept. So rather than like having this image of a vampire, I think they had more of a concept of like energy being stolen, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Fair enough.
So I don't know how we discovered what vampires should look like, but it sounds like some people think that they should be, you know, bloated and dead and creepy.
That's so very like, different from like my image of a vampire.
Yeah, like you already said, Tilly, they look European with long hair. Yeah. That's what you said.
Not
stylish counts.
Yeah. So like for me, a vampire now, I mean, back a historical vampire is literally a corpse, isn't it really? But then now, if you look at the modern media and fantasy media around vampires, they're hot.
Yes.
Like
they
are. They're good looking people.
Yeah. And even if they're not before they become a vampire, they miraculously become good looking like after.
Yeah. Like Bella Swan suddenly becoming super hot.
Which I also like that they're like, oh, look, now she's good looking. And you're like, oh, great. Yeah, because before she was a complete troll.
Yeah. Oh, look, she took off her glasses.
Yeah, oh, my God.
Yeah, right? Oh, she's cut her fringe. She's straightened her hair and she's taken her glasses off. Oh, my God.
To be fair, though, as someone who has to constantly wear glasses, I would definitely turn into a vampire just for good eyesight. So.
Oh, for sure. Same here.
Oh, there's books flying around again.
Oh, God. Is there? Oh, God, they're so active today. What have you been feeding them, Tilly?
I don't know, just some bookworms. Oh, God, one of them just tried to eat my hair. Hang on a sec. Okay, I'm really sorry, everyone. We're going to have to cut short this episode of And My Trail, but don't you worry, we haven't finished. We're going to be continuing our chat with Jess in our next episode with part two. In the meantime, don't forget, we're always looking for new episode ideas, so if you do have any suggestions, please get in contact via email or social media. All contact info plus anything that we have referenced during our chat with Jess today can be found in the show notes. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.